He's got what is sometimes unkindly referred to as a hatchet face. There is nothing warm about him. But there's something familiar. He bears a strong resemblance to the family who lived in the house when I was growing up. Some of the kids were close to my age, and I knew them from around town. He must be an older brother, I realize, and either bought or inherited the house from his parents. The man looks at Terry with no recognition. I see Terry is undeterred, and unease washes over me. I have a mother's instinct to reach out, redirect, and quiet down. But I can see Terry wants to distinguish himself in the man's memory. They are old neighbors, after all.
"I'm one of the boys that found the body," Terry shouts.
The man stares at Terry from the side of his car. He says nothing. The blankness is emphatically hostile. I look away, directing my gaze at a tiny Virgin Mary statue planted in the northeast corner of the front lawn. It's Saturday afternoon, June 29th, 2013, an unusually cold and windy day for midsummer Chicago. In the sky, a block to the west, I can see the steeple of St. Edmund Catholic Church, my family's old church where I went to school from first through third grades. The man returns to tinkering with his car. Terry peels off to the right. He spots me 30 yards down the sidewalk. I light up at eye contact and wave furiously at him, compensation for what just transpired. Terry was a year above me at St. Edmund's. The last time I remember seeing him was 35 years ago. I know little about him aside from the recent discovery that the same night in August 1984 changed both our lives.
"Michelle!" he shouts, walking toward me. "How's Hollywood?"
We hug awkwardly. His manner brings me back immediately to the Oak Park of my childhood. The flat vowels in his thick Chicago accent. The way he announces later that he has to haul ass. He's got a cowlick, a raw pink color to his cheeks, and an utter lack of artifice. No calculating mechanism filters his thought from speech. He starts in right away.
"So yeah, what happened was," he says, leading me back toward the house.
I hesitate. Maybe it's fear of the already unhappy homeowner's reaction. Maybe it's my sense that walking might help transport us to that muggy summer night when we still rode bikes but had tasted our first sip of beer. I look south down the alley. "How about we retrace the path you guys took that night?" Oak Park borders the west side of Chicago. Ernest Hemingway, who grew up there, famously referred to it as a town of wide lawns and narrow minds. But that wasn't my experience of the place. We lived in a drafty three-story Victorian on the 300 block of South Scoville, a cul-de-sac in the center of town. North of us was the Frank Lloyd Wright home and studio, and an affluent neighborhood of prairie homes and liberal professionals intent on staying hip. My friend Cameron lived in one of the Wright homes. Her stepfather was a civil rights attorney, and her mother was, I think, a potter. They introduced me to vegetarian salt and the word kabuki. I remember the stepfather recommending that Cameron and I, who both tended toward black smocks and confessional verse, cheer ourselves up by going to see the Talking Heads concert movie, Stop Making Sense. South of us was mostly blue-collar Irish Catholic families. The houses were always a few degrees too cold, and the beds lacked headboards. Occasionally a father would disappear with a 20-year-old, never to be seen again, but there would be no divorce. A college friend who spent sophomore year spring break with my family was convinced that my father was doing a comedy bit when he began updating me on the local gossip. The last names, she said, were so exclusively, defiantly Irish. The Connollys, the Flannerys, the O'Learys, and on and on. I overheard a weary Irish Catholic mother from Oak Park field a question about my family once. "How many McNamara kids are there?" she was asked. "Only six," she said. She had 11. My family had a foot in both sides of Oak Park. My parents were natives, members of the tribe commonly referred to as West Side Irish. They met in high school. My father was gap-toothed and jolly. He liked to laugh. My mother was the teetotaling eldest daughter of two hard partiers. She loved Judy Garland and had a lifelong fascination with Hollywood.
"People used to tell me I resembled Jean Tierney," she told me shyly once.
I didn't know who that was. When I saw Laura years later,
the mysterious central character who shared my mother's cascade of golden-flecked brown hair and delicately cut cheekbones mesmerized me. The story is that my parents got together when my father knocked on my mother's door, looking, allegedly, for a friend of his. I believe it. The indirect approach to emotional matters suited them. They both had enormous eyes, my father's blue, my mother's green, that expressed with great feeling what they frequently could not. My father briefly considered the seminary while away at Notre Dame. They called him Brother Leo. My mother considered other suitors and doodled alternate possibilities of her future last name. But Brother Leo decided the seminarians didn't drink enough. Their friend, Reverend Malachy Dooley, officiated their wedding the day after Christmas, 1955. My eldest sister, Margot, was born the following September. Teased my mother with a raised eyebrow about the math, and her cheeks burned. Her nickname in high school was Goody Two-Shoes. After Northwestern Law School, my father went to work for the firm Jenner & Block downtown. He stayed 38 years. Most days began for him in a chair on our screened-in front porch, one hand holding the Chicago Tribune, the other a cup of tea, and ended with a very dry beef-eater martini on the rocks with a twist. When he decided to get sober in 1990, he announced the news in his usual quirky way. Each child received a typewritten form letter. "To my favorite child," it began, "I've decided to join the Pepsi generation." He later claimed that only two children believed the salutation. I was one of them. My siblings arrived in quick succession, four girls and a boy. I was the youngest, born after a six-year gap. My sister closest to me in age, Mary Rita, was too much older than me to be a real playmate. Looking back now, it feels as though I was born into a party that had started to wind down. By the time I came around, my parents had matching lazy boy armchairs. Our front door was partly glass, and standing there you could see the back of my mother's beige armchair in the living room. When any of the kids' friends rang the doorbell, she'd stick her hand up and make a circling motion. "Go around," she'd shout, directing them to the unlocked back door. The families on our block were close, but the kids were all the same ages as my older siblings. They ran in a pack and returned home at dusk. I have a keen memory of what it was like to be a teenager in the 70s because I spent a lot of time with them. My sister Kathleen, 10 years older, was and is the most extroverted of our family, and she toted me around like a beloved toy. I remember teetering precariously on the back of her banana seat as she pedaled to the Jewel grocery store on Madison Street. Everyone seemed to know her. "Hey, Beanie," they called, using her nickname. In Beanie's freshman year of high school, she developed an all-consuming crush on Anton, a quiet, blonde-haired boy who ran track. She took me with her to one of his meets. We hid high up in the bleachers to peek at him. I remember the love-wrecked expression on her face as we watched him explode forth from the starting line. I didn't realize it then, but I was losing her to the complexities of high school. Soon I was sitting alone on the top of the back stairs that connected our kitchen to the second floor, watching teenage boys in sideburns chug beers in our breakfast nook as the Steve Miller Band's The Joker played too loud. Everyone in my family speaks mock reverently about the day in 1974 when the Van sisters, Lisa, my age, Chris, a year older, moved in across the street. "Thank God," they tease. "What would we have done with you?" Many of my parents' closest friends were from grammar school and high school. That they'd maintained such close bonds in an increasingly unmoored and transient world was a point of pride for them, as it should be. But it also had the effect, I think, of insulating them. Take them out of their comfort zone, and they became a little ill at ease. I think an undercurrent of shyness ran through them both. They gravitated toward bigger personalities. They used humor, sometimes sharply, to deflect tension. My mother especially seemed always in a state of suppressing emotions, expectations. She had small freckled hands and a habit of tugging her fingers when things got unpleasant. I don't mean to give the wrong impression. They were bright, curious people who traveled the world once they could afford to. My father argued, and lost, a case in front of the Supreme Court in 1971 that still studied in constitutional law classes. They subscribed to The New Yorker. They always had an interest in popular culture and what was considered good or cool. My mother allowed herself to be taken to see Boogie Nights. I'm going to watch The Sound of Music 20 times in a row to forget that, she said.
They were Kennedy Democrats. Politically progressive, my mother liked to say, but socially conservative.
My father took my older sisters when they were 10 and 8 downtown to see Martin Luther King speak. They voted for Mondale in 84. But when I was 19, my mother once woke me at dawn in a panic, shaking a handful of unfamiliar, to her, pills. She couldn't bring herself to say pill.
You're on the, she said.
Fiber, I said, and turned back to sleep. But then our relationship was always fraught. My sister Maureen remembers coming home when I was around 2 and finding my mother pacing the front porch.
I don't know if I'm crazy, she said, fighting tears, or Michelle.
My mother was 40 then. She had endured alcoholic parents and the death of an infant son. She was raising 6 kids with no help. I'm sure I was the crazy one. Her lifelong nickname for me, only half-jokingly, was the Little Witch. We button-pushed our whole lives. She stonewalled. I glowered. She scribbled notes on envelopes and slid them under my bedroom door.
You're vain, thoughtless, and rude, a notorious one went, concluding, but you're my daughter, and of course I love you very much.
We had a summer cabin on Lake Michigan, and I remember one afternoon as a kid playing in the waves as she read a book in a chair on the beach. I realized that the waves were just high enough so that I could remain underwater and then rise for a quick breath when the wave was at its highest, shielding me from view. I let my mother straighten up and scan the water. I let her put down her book. I let her stand. I let her run toward the water, preparing to scream. Only then did I pop up nonchalantly. I wish now that I'd been kinder to her. I used to rib her about the fact that she couldn't bear to watch certain scenes in movies or on TV shows. She couldn't take scenes in which someone threw a party and no one came. She avoided movies about salesmen down on their luck. The specificity was what I found peculiar and amusing. I now see it as the mark of a deeply sensitive person. Her father was once a successful salesman whose career bottomed out. She witnessed her parents' problems with alcohol and the insistent mime of merrymaking that went on too long. I see her vulnerabilities now. Her parents valued social success and dismissed signs of my mother's quick, eager mind. She felt thwarted. She could be undermining and cutting in her remarks, but the older me sees that as a reflection of her own undercut self-image. We swim or sink against our deficits in life, and she made it a point to encourage me in ways that she had not been. I remember that she dissuaded me from trying out for cheerleading in high school.
"Don't you want to be the one cheered?" she said.
She thrilled at any of my academic or literary successes. When I was in high school, I came across a letter she'd started to write years before to Aunt Marilyn, my father's sister, who was a theology professor and accomplished archaeologist. My mother was looking for advice on how to best encourage me as a young writer.
"How do I make sure she doesn't end up writing greeting cards?" she wrote.
I thought of that question often in future years, during the many periods when I would have been ecstatic to be paid to write Hallmark greetings. But I felt her expectations, the transference of hope, and I bristled. I both yearned for her approval and found her investment in me suffocating. She was both proud of the fact that she had raised a strong-minded daughter and resentful of my sharp opinions. It didn't help matters that my generation was deep into analysis and deconstruction, and hers was not. My mother didn't, or wouldn't, navel-gaze in that way. I remember talking with my sister Maureen once about the severe short haircuts we all had as children. "Doesn't it seem like Mom was trying to desexualize us?" I asked. Maureen, the mother of 3, suppressed a laugh mixed with irritation. "Wait until you have kids, Michelle," she said. "Short haircuts aren't desexualizing. They're easy." The night before my wedding, my mother and I had our biggest blowout. I was unemployed and adrift, not writing or doing much of anything, and I'd put a lot of time, too much probably, into the wedding. At the rehearsal dinner, I seated small groups of people who didn't know each other together. The only thing I told them was that they all had one thing in common and had to figure out what it was. At one table, everyone had lived at some point in Minnesota. Another table was avid cooks. In the middle of dinner, my mother came up to me as I was making my way toward the bathroom. I'd been avoiding her because a friend had made the mistake of telling me that earlier in the evening she'd remarked to my mother that she thought I was the best writer she knew.
Oh, I know. I think so, too, my mother said. But don't you think it's too late for her?
Her words stung and batted around in my head all night. I saw her out of the corner of my eye coming toward me. In retrospect, she was smiling. I could see she was pleased with everything. She was never good at giving compliments directly. I'm sure she thought she was being funny. She gestured at the tables.
You have too much time on your hands, she said.
I turned and faced her with what I'm sure was a mask of pure rage. Get away from me, I spit out. She was shocked and tried to explain, but I cut her off. Walk away from me. Now. I went to the ladies' room, locked myself in a stall, and allowed myself to cry for 5 minutes. Then went back out and pretended that everything was fine. She was, by all accounts, devastated by my reaction. We never spoke of it, but shortly after the wedding, she wrote me a long letter detailing all the things about me that made her proud. We slowly rebuilt our relationship after that. In late January 2007, my parents decided to take a cruise to Costa Rica. The boat would leave from a port south of Los Angeles. The four of us, my husband, Patton, and I, and my parents, had dinner the night before their trip. We laughed a lot, and I drove them to the dock in the morning. My mother and I hugged tightly goodbye. A few days later, the phone in the kitchen rang at 4 a.m. I didn't get up. Then it rang again, but stopped before I could get to it. I listened to the voicemail. It was my father. His voice sounded strangled and almost unintelligible.
Michelle, he said, call your siblings.
Click. I called my sister Maureen.
You don't know? She asked.
What?
Oh, Michelle, she said. Mom died.
My mother, a diabetic, had fallen ill on the ship due to complications from her disease. They helicoptered her to San Jose, but it was too late. She was 74. 2 years later, my daughter Alice was born. I was inconsolable for the first 2 weeks.
Postpartum depression, my husband explained to friends.
But it wasn't new mom blues. It was old mom blues. Holding my newborn daughter, I got it. I got the love that guts you, the sense of responsibility that narrows the world to a pair of needy eyes. At 39, I understood my mother's love for me for the first time. Sobbing hysterically, almost unable to speak, I ordered my husband to go down into our dank basement and find the letter my mother had written to me after the wedding. He spent hours down there. Every box was overturned. Papers littered the floor. He couldn't find it. Shortly after my mother's death, my father, sisters, brother, and I went to my parents' apartment in Deerfield Beach, Florida, to sort through her stuff. We sniffed her clothes that still smelled like Happy perfume by Clinique. We marveled at her bottomless collection of bags, a lifelong obsession. Each of us took something of hers. I took a pair of pink and white sandals. They sit in my closet still. Afterward, the seven of us went to an early dinner at the Sea Watch, a nearby restaurant overlooking the ocean. We're laughers, my family, and we told stories about my mother that made us laugh. Seven people laughing loudly create a scene. An older woman with a bemused smile came up to our table as she was leaving.
"What's the secret?" she asked.
"I'm sorry," my brother Bob said.
"To such a happy family."
We sat agape for a few moments. No one had the heart to say what we were all thinking. We've just been cleaning out our dead mother's belongings. We dissolved into more shrieking laughter. My mother was, and will always be, the most complicated relationship of my life. Writing this now, I'm struck by two incompatible truths that pain me. No one would have taken more joy from this book than my mother, and I probably wouldn't have felt the freedom to write it until she was gone. I walked the same half mile to St. Edmund's every day, a left on Randolph, a right on Euclid, a left on Pleasant. The girls wore gray plaid jumpers and white shirts, the boys a mustard-colored collared shirt and slacks. Ms. Ray, my first grade teacher, had an hourglass figure and a thick mane of caramel-colored hair, and she was always upbeat. It was Suzanne Summers herding a bunch of six-year-olds. Even so, she's not my most vivid memory of St. Edmund's. Nor, curiously enough, is any Catholic teaching or time spent in church, though I know there were a lot of both. No, St. Edmund's will always be welded in my mind with one image, that of a quiet, well-behaved boy with sandy brown hair and ears that stuck out a little, Danny Olas. My schooltime crushes ranged wildly in physical and personality type, but I can say with confidence that they all shared one thing. They sat in front of me in class. Other people are able to develop feelings for people sitting next to them or behind them, but not me. That requires connecting with someone too directly, sometimes even craning your neck to make full eye contact. Too real. I loved nothing more than the back of a boy's head. I could project endlessly on the blank slate of a kid's slouched back. He could be sitting there with his mouth half open or picking his nose, and I'd never know. For a dreamy projectionist like me, Danny Olas was perfect. I don't recall thinking he was unhappy, but I also can't picture his smile. He was self-possessed for a little kid, and slightly solemn, as if he knew something the rest of us gap-toothed fairy tale believers would eventually find out. He was the Sam Shepard of our first grade class. I'd been gifted with a stuffed Curious George when I was born, and something about Danny's round elfin face and big ears reminded me of my George doll. I fell asleep clutching him to my cheek every night. My love for Danny was big news in our house. Sifting through my old stuff during a move once, I came across a card Beanie had written me during her freshman year at the University of Iowa. Dear Mish, I miss you. How's Danny Olas? I switched to the local public school, William By Elementary, for fourth grade. My best friends, the Van sisters, who'd saved me from loneliness by moving in across the street, went there. I wanted to be with them. I wanted to wear whatever I liked. After a while, I mostly forgot about Danny Olas. My Curious George disappeared, along with my other childhood things. One night in my junior year of high school, a friend was helping me prepare for a big party I was throwing while my parents were out of town. She'd been hanging out the last few months with some boys from Fenwick, the local all-boys Catholic high school, and asked if a few of them could come to the party. Sure, I said. Actually, she told me tentatively, she was sort of dating one of them. Just kind of, she said. That's great, I said. What's his name? Danny Olas. My eyes widened and I half guffawed, half shrieked. I steadied myself and took a breath, the way you do when you're about to share a big secret. You're not going to believe this, I said, but I had the biggest crush on Danny Olas in grade school. My friend nodded. It started in music class because the teacher made you hold hands, she said. My confused expression prompted her to continue. He told me, she said. I recalled nothing about holding hands in music class. And he knew? In my memory, I was the quiet girl who sat in the back, faithfully but discreetly observing every swivel and dip of his head. Now it seemed my fixation had been about as subtle as a telenovela. I was mortified. Well, he's very mysterious, I told her a little irritated. She shrugged. Not to me, she said. That night, teenagers with solo cups spilled onto my lawn and into the street. I drank too much gin and ducked and weaved through the throngs of unfamiliar people in my house. Boys I'd dated were there, and boys I would date. Someone played Suspicious Minds by the Fine Young Cannibals on repeat. All night I was acutely aware of a quiet, sandy-haired boy standing in the corner of the kitchen near the refrigerator. His hair now covered his ears. His face had lost its roundness and was more drawn. But through quick glimpses I could see the steady, cryptic expression remained. All night I avoided him. I never looked him in the eye. Despite the gin, I was still the girl in the back of the classroom. Watchful. Never watched. 26 years later, one afternoon in May, I was preparing to close my laptop when the familiar ring announced a new email. I glanced at my inbox. I'm an inconsistent email correspondent, and sometimes, I'm a little ashamed to admit, it takes me several days or longer to respond. The name in my inbox took a moment to register. Dan Olas. I clicked on the message hesitantly. Dan, who was now an engineer living in Denver, explained that he had been forwarded a profile of me that ran in the Notre Dame Alumni Magazine. The article, Sleuth, reported that I was the author of a website, True Crime Diary, that attempts to solve cold case homicides. The writer asked the origin of my obsession with unsolved murders and quoted my reply. This all started when I was 14. A neighbor of mine was brutally murdered. Very strange case. She was jogging close to her house. The police never solved it. Everyone in the neighborhood was gripped with fear and then moved on. But I never could. I had to figure out how it happened. That was the soundbite version. Another version is as follows. On the evening of August 1, 1984, I'm basking in the hermetically sealed freedom of our house's renovated third-floor attic bedroom. Every kid in my family spent part of their teenage years up there. It's my turn. My father hated the attic because it was a fire trap. But for me, a 14-year-old tsunami of emotions who signed her journal entries, Michelle the Writer, it's a glorious escape. The carpet is deep orange shag, the ceiling slanted. There's a bookcase built into the wall that swings open to a secret storage nook. Best of all is the enormous wooden desk that takes up half the room. I have a turntable, a typewriter, and a small window that overlooks my neighbor's tiled roof. I have a place to dream. In a few weeks, I'll start high school. At the same time, 3/10 of a mile away, Kathleen Lombardo, 24, is jogging with her Walkman along Pleasant Street. It's a hot night. Neighbors out on their porch watch Kathleen go by about 9:45 p.m. She has minutes to live. I remember hearing someone walk upstairs to the second floor, my sister Maureen, I think, and a murmured conversation, an intake of breath, and then my mother's footsteps going quickly to the window. We knew the Lombardo family from St. Edmunds. Word trickled out quickly. Her killer had dragged her into the mouth of the alley between Euclid and Wesley. He cut her throat. I had no particular interest in crime aside from reading the occasional Nancy Drew book growing up. Yet 2 days after the killing, without telling anyone, I walked to the spot near our house where Kathleen had been attacked. On the ground, I saw pieces of her shattered Walkman. I picked them up. I felt no fear, just an electric curiosity, a current of such unexpected, searching force that I can recall every detail about the moment. The smell of newly cut grass, the chipped brown paint on the garage door. What gripped me was the specter of that question mark where the killer's face should be. The hollow gap of his identity seemed violently powerful to me. Unsolved murders became an obsession. I was a hoarder of ominous and puzzling details. I developed a Pavlovian response to the word mystery. My library record was a bibliography of the macabre and true. When I meet people and hear where they're from, I orient them in my mind by the nearest unsolved crime. Tell me you went to Miami University of Ohio, and every time I see you, I'll think of Ron Tamman, the wrestler and bassist in the school jazz band, who walked out of his dorm room on April 19, 1953, his radio playing, the light on, his psychology book open, and vanished, never to be seen again. Mention you're from Yorktown, Virginia, and I'll forever connect you with the Colonial Parkway, the ribbon of road snaking along the York River, where four couples either disappeared or were murdered between 1986 and 1989. In my mid-30s, I finally embraced my fascination, and thanks to the advent of internet technology, my DIY detective website, True Crime Diary, was born. Why are you so interested in crime? People ask me. And I always go back to that moment in the alley, the shards of a dead girl's Walkman in my hands. I need to see his face. He loses his power when we know his face. Kathleen Lombardo's murder was never solved. I would write about her case now and again and mention it in interviews. I even called the Oak Park police to fact-check some things. The only real lead was that witnesses reported seeing an African-American man in a yellow tank top and headband watching Kathleen intently as she jogged. The police debunked a rumor, I remember, that witnesses had seen the killer exit the L train and begin following Kathleen. The rumor's intent was obvious. The murderer had slipped in among us from somewhere else. The Oak Park cops gave me the distinct impression that the case was a dead end. And that's where I thought it stood, until that day when Dan Olis's name appeared in my inbox. Dan had copied another person on his email to me, Terry Keating. I vaguely recognized the name as a boy a year above us at St. Edmunds. Dan and Terry, it turns out, are first cousins. They were reaching out to me because they, too, were haunted by Kathleen Lombardo's murder, but for different and far more personal reasons. In his email, Dan said, "Hello, how are you?" then got right to the point. "Did you know that some nice St. Edmunds boys found Kathleen?" he wrote. The experience had been gruesome and rattling for the kids. They spoke of it often, Dan wrote, mostly because they were angry. The well-known, accepted theory of what happened to Kathleen that night was wrong, in their opinion. They felt they knew the identity of her killer. In fact, they had encountered him that night. Terry and Dan are not only cousins. They shared a house growing up. Dan's family lived on the first floor, Terry's on the second, and their grandmother on the third. Terry and I surveyed the back of the old place from the alley. "How many people would that be?" I asked Terry. "The house is about 3,000 square feet at most."
11 kids, 5 adults," he says.
Just a year apart, Dan and Terry were and remain close.
"That summer was a real transition time for us," Terry says. "Sometimes we stole beers and got drunk. Other times we messed around like when we were kids."
He gestures at the slab of concrete that abuts the garage in the backyard.
"I remember we were playing hockey, or maybe basketball that night."
The group comprised Terry, Danny, Danny's younger brother Tom, and two grade school friends, Mike and Darren. It was a little before 10 p.m. Someone suggested they head down the alley to the White Hen, a small convenience store on Euclid, about a block and a half away. They went to the White Hen all the time, sometimes 3 or 4 times a day, for a Kit Kat or a Coke. Terry and I head north from the house. He spent so much time in this alley as a kid, he can spot all the little ways it's changed.
"It was darker at night back then," he says, "like a cave almost. The branches would stick out and hang down more."
An unfamiliar tree in a neighbor's backyard draws his attention.
"Bamboo," he says. "Can you believe it?"
About 50 feet from where the alley intersects with Pleasant Street, Terry stops. A gaggle of preteen and teen boys shooting the shit, as Terry recalls them doing, can be raucous. They distracted themselves with goofball antics. This spot haunts him. Looking straight ahead, you can see the mouth of the alley across the street.
"If we'd been paying attention, we might have seen her run by," he says. "We might have seen him grab her."
We cross the street to the alcove behind 143 South Wesley Avenue. The five boys were walking together in a straight line. Danny was on his right, Terry remembers. He puts a hand on the fence near the garage and rattles it.
"I think this is the same fence, but it was painted red then," Terry says.
He thought he glimpsed a rolled-up rug near the garbage cans. Kathleen's legs were very pale, and in the dark, Terry mistook them for a light-colored carpet. Then Danny, who was closest to her, shouted,
"That's a body!"
Terry and I stare at the spot alongside the garage where Kathleen lay on her back. It was clear immediately that her throat had been slashed. Blood pooled around her feet. There was a terrible smell. Probably her stomach gases, Terry guesses now. Darren, a delicate kid, as Terry describes him, walked slowly backward to the opposite garage with his hands on top of his head, bugging out. Tom took off toward the nearest back door, yelling for help. The next moment is where the accepted narrative of Kathleen Lombardo's murder diverges from Terry and Dan's memory. They remember that Kathleen still had vital signs, but died in the minutes between their discovery of her and the arrival of a swarm of police. They remember the detectives telling them they must have just walked up on the guy. They remember a man emerging from the alley almost simultaneously as they discovered Kathleen's body. He was tall and appeared to be of Indian descent. He wore a linen shirt open to his navel, shorts and sandals.
"What's going on here?" he asked.
Terry says the man never looked in the direction of the body.
"Someone's hurt! We need to call the police!" Mike shouted at the man.
The man shook his head.
"I don't have a phone," he said.
The chaos of the scene obscures the next sequence of events. Terry remembers the patrol car pulling up, driven by a skeptical, uniformed cop with a mustache who asked sarcastically where the body was. He remembers the change in tone and urgent radio for help when the cop saw Kathleen. He remembers the cop's partner, a younger guy, maybe even a trainee, leaning against the side of the car, retching. He remembers Darren against the garage, his hands still to his head, rocking back and forth. And then a siege of lights and sirens, the likes of which Terry had never seen before or since. 7 years later, Terry happened to carpool to a concert with a guy named Tom McBride, who lived a few doors down from the murder scene. Terry and Tom had been enemies as kids, in the way you are when you don't know each other and go to different schools. Tom, Terry says, was a public, as the Catholic kids called them. But Terry discovered that Tom was actually a really good guy. They gabbed all night. "Weren't you one of the kids that found that body?" Tom asked. Terry said he was. Tom's eyes narrowed. "I always thought someone in the neighborhood did it." An image came back to Terry, the man in the open linen shirt, the strange way he wouldn't look at Kathleen's body. The way he'd asked them what was going on here, when it was clear something horrible was. Terry's stomach tightened. "What did he look like?" Terry asked. Tom described him. Tall, from India, a real creep. "He was right there when we found her," Terry said. Tom's color drained. He couldn't believe it. He remembered clearly that in the clamor after the discovery of the body, the neighbor, who appeared freshly showered and was dressed in a robe, came out his back door to survey the police cars. He'd turned to Tom and his family, who were out on their back porch. "Did he say anything?" Terry asked. Tom nodded. "What's going on here?" the neighbor said. They never caught her killer. And those pieces of her shattered Walkman that I picked up at her crime scene are jangling around in my head 30 years later as I steer my rental car onto Capitol Avenue in Sacramento. I take it east, out of town, until it turns into Folsom Boulevard. I stay on Folsom, past Sac State and the Sutter Center for Psychiatry, past the empty lots of scrub and scattered oak trees. Running parallel on my right is the Gold Line, a light rail transit system that runs from downtown to Folsom, 25 miles east. The route is historic. The tracks were once used for the Sacramento Valley Railroad, built in 1856, the first steam railroad to connect the city with the mining camps in the Sierras. Crossing Bradshaw Road, I spot signs reading Pawn and Six Pocket Sports Bar. Across the road are petroleum storage tanks behind a rusty chain-link fence. I'm at my destination. Where it all started. The city of Rancho Cordova. Sacramento, 1976 to 1977. In the 70s, kids who didn't live here called it Rancho Cambodia. The American River bisects the east side of Sacramento County, and Rancho Cordova, on the south bank, is cut off from the leafier, more genteel suburbs on the other side of the river. The area began as a Mexican land grant of 5,000 acres for farming. In 1848, after James W. Marshall, 35 miles upriver, glimpsed glittering metal flakes in a water wheel drain and declared, "I have found it," the gold dredges descended on Rancho Cordova, leaving huge piles of river rock behind. For a while it was a vineyard. Mather Air Force Base opened in 1918. But it was the Cold War that really changed Rancho Cordova. In 1953, Aerojet, the rocket and missile propulsion manufacturer, opened its headquarters here. And with it came a boom in residential housing for its employees. The town's twisty roads, Zinfandel Drive, Riesling Way, suddenly paved and neatly divided into modest single-story tract houses. Everyone's family seemed associated with the military or Aerojet. A rougher element lurked. A man who grew up on La Gloria Way in the mid-70s remembers the day the ice cream man who worked around Cordova Meadows Elementary School disappeared. Turns out the guy with the long hair, big beard, and mirrored aviator glasses who had been selling the kids popsicles was selling LSD and cocaine to a different set of clientele, and he was hauled away by the cops. Stories of growing up in Sacramento in the 70s are often bait and switches like this, a tangle of sweet and scary, small-town postcards with foreboding on the back. "On hot summer days, we waded in the American River," a woman recalls. Then another memory, this one of running along the trails by the river and coming upon a homeless camp in the dense brush. Parts of the river were said to be haunted. A group of teenage girls hung out at Land Park and watched shirtless boys wax their cars. They went to Days on the Green in Oakland, that era's Lollapalooza, to see the Eagles or Peter Frampton or Jethro Tull. They drove up to the Sutterville Road levee and drank beer. They were on the levee drinking the night of April 14, 1978, when a convoy of squad cars, sirens blaring, flew past them on the road below. The convoy was endless.
"Never saw anything like it before or since," one of the teenagers, now a 52-year-old woman, said.
The East Area Rapist, or EAR, the man I would come to call the Golden State Killer, had struck again. From Folsom, I took a left onto Paseo Drive, into the heart of residential Rancho Cordova. This place meant something to him. He attacked here first and kept coming back. By November 1976, there were 9 attacks in Sacramento County attributed to the East Area Rapist in 6 months. 4 of those took place in Rancho Cordova. In March 1979, when he hadn't attacked in a year and it seemed he'd left for good, he came back to Rancho Cordova one last time. Was it home? Some of the investigators, especially the ones who worked the case in the beginning, think so. I pulled up to the site of his first attack, a simple L-shaped single-story house, about 1,000 square feet, with a cleanly shorn tree stump in the center of the yard. It was here that the first call came in, at 5 a.m. on June 18, 1976, from a 23-year-old woman who was speaking into the receiver as best she could from where she lay on the floor, her hands tied behind her back so tightly that she'd lost circulation. Sheila, not her real name, had backed up to the phone on her father's nightstand, knocked it to the ground, and searched with her fingers for zero. She was calling to report a home invasion rape. She wanted them to understand that the mask was strange. It was white and made of a coarse, knit-like material, with eye holes and a seam down the middle. But it fit very tight against his face. When Sheila opened her eyes and saw him in her bedroom doorway, she thought she was dreaming. Who wears a ski mask in Sacramento in June? She blinked and absorbed more of the image. He was about 5'9", moderately muscular, wearing a navy blue short-sleeve t-shirt and gray canvas gloves. Another detail, so unnatural it must have strayed in from her subconscious. A pair of pale legs with dark hair. The parts flew together and formed a whole. The man wasn't wearing pants. He was erect. His chest rose and fell, exhalations of the real. He leaped onto Sheila's bed and pressed the blade of a 4-inch knife against her right temple. She pulled the covers over her head to will him away. He yanked them off.
"If you make one move or sound, I'll stick this knife in you," he whispered.
He tied her wrists behind her back with cord he brought with him, then tied them again with a red and white fabric belt he found in Sheila's closet. He stuffed one of her white nylon slips into her mouth as a gag. Already hints existed of the behavior that would become so recognizable. He put baby oil on his penis before he raped her. He rummaged and ransacked. She could hear the little knocker handles on the side tables in the living room clattering as he opened drawers. He spoke in a low, guttural whisper with a clenched jaw. A 1-inch cut near her right eyebrow bled from where he'd pressed the knife, ordering her not to make a sound. Common sense, and any cop, will tell you that the no-pants rapist is an unsophisticated teenage peeper who just graduated from misdemeanor to crudely conceived felony. The punk doing the no-pants dance suffers from poor impulse control and will be arrested swiftly. His lingering stare has no doubt afforded him creep status in the neighborhood. The cops will kick him awake at his agitated mother's house in no time. But this no-pants punk wasn't caught. There exists something that I think of as the paradox of the smart rapist. Roy Hazelwood, a former FBI profiler who specializes in sexual predators, talks about it in the book The Evil That Men Do, co-written by Stephen G. Michaud. Most people have no trouble connecting intelligence with a complex robbery. But rape torture is a depraved act which they cannot remotely relate to. They therefore resist crediting such offenders with intelligence. This is true even of police officers. A closer look at Sheila's rapist's methods reveals a calculating mind at work. He was careful to never remove his gloves. Sheila received hang-up phone calls in the weeks leading up to the attack, as if someone were monitoring her schedule. In April, she had the feeling she was being followed. She kept seeing a dark, medium-sized American-made car. But it was curious. Though she felt sure it was the same car, she could never quite make out the driver. The night of the attack, a birdbath had been moved to a spot under the telephone line in the backyard, evidently to stand on. But the line was only partially cut, the clumsy hesitation mark of a trainee, like the bent nail of an apprentice carpenter. 4 months later, Richard Shelby was standing on a curb on Shadowbrook Way in Citrus Heights. Based on the rules of the Sacramento Sheriff's Department, Shelby should not have been on this or any other case. He shouldn't have even been in uniform. Shelby knew the rules. To work for the Sacramento Sheriff's Department in 1966, you had to have all 10 digits in their entirety. But he had passed the written exam and physical, and thought he'd try his luck. Luck had been good to him. Even the fact that he was missing a good portion of his left ring finger was lucky. He should have been cut in half by the hunter's errant shotgun blast. The doctors told him he came very close to losing the whole hand. When the screener spotted Shelby's finger, he halted the interview. Shelby was curtly dismissed. He wouldn't be joining the Sacramento Sheriff's Department after all. The rejection smarted. All his life, Shelby had heard his family speak reverently of an uncle who was a sheriff in Oklahoma. Maybe it was a sign. He wanted to work in a less populated county anyway, Yolo or Placer. The Central Valley's open spaces were the landscape of his youth. Summers he'd worked outside on the ranches and farms of East Merced County, skinny-dipped in the canals, hunted rabbit and quail in the lower foothills of the Sierra Nevada. The SSD's failure to pass letter arrived a week later. Then, the next day, another letter arrived. This one told him where and when to report for work. Shelby called for an explanation. Vietnam was becoming big news. In February 1965, the monthly draft was 3,000. The number had increased to 33,000 by October. Protests began throughout the country, turning incrementally more raucous. Available young men were growing scarce. The SSD saw Shelby as a new and relatively rare phenomenon. He had joined the Air Force more than a decade before, 13 days after his 17th birthday, and completed duty. He had a college degree in criminal justice. He was married. And despite what he was lacking finger-wise, he could out-type the sheriff's secretary. They changed the rules about finger length. Shelby reported for work August 1, 1966. He stayed 27 years. The SSD was far from a slick place back then. Everyone competed for the one squad car that had a gooseneck lamp and clipboard affixed to the dash. The armory still had Tommy guns from the 1920s. The sirens were located right on top of the cars. The cops who drove them wear hearing aids now. Specialized divisions like the one for sex crimes didn't exist. You were the expert with hands-on experience if you picked up the phone and were called to a rape scene once. That's why Shelby found himself on the morning of October 5th, 1976, on the curb at Shadowbrook Way. A bloodhound following a scent trail had brought him to the spot. The trail began at a child's bedroom window, continued over a fence and through a field of weeds, stopping at the curb. Shelby knocked on the nearest door and looked across the field toward the victim's house, a distance of about 200 feet. He wished away his unease. An hour and a half earlier, shortly after 6:30 a.m., Jane Carson had been cuddling in bed with her 3-year-old son when she heard a light switch go on and off, and then someone running down the hallway. Her husband had left for work moments before. "Jack, is that you? Did you forget something?" A man in a greenish-brown ski mask came through the door. "Shut up. I want your money. I won't hurt you," he said. Shelby found the precision timing interesting. The man entered the house through the son's bedroom window just moments after Jane's husband left. They'd been the victims of an unusual burglary 2 weeks before, in which the thief took 10 or so of their rings and left behind some neighbor's stolen jewelry. The thief had also entered and exited through the son's window. Same guy, Shelby thought. A methodical and patient one. Jane's rape would end up being the fifth assault attributed to the East Area Rapist, but it was the first one worked by Shelby and Carol Daly,
two detectives who would become inextricably linked to the series. A female detective with experience in sex crimes, Daly was a natural fit to conduct the victim interviews. Her people skills would eventually rocket her all the way to the job of undersheriff. Shelby, however, had a knack for pissing people off. He would call on colleagues to handle suspect interrogations, as his tended to devolve into chaos. He was always butting heads with the fourth floor, the top brass. His problem stemmed less from arrogance than plainspokenness. He lacked finesse. A childhood spent roaming a flat landscape empty of people could keep one from developing certain communication skills. "The ability to be tactful has always eluded me," he says. There were three more attacks in quick succession that October. At first, many of his colleagues thought an unidentified serial offender known as the Early Bird Rapist was responsible, but Shelby knew they were up against a smarter and weirder man than the Early Bird. These were the days before criminal profiling, before terms like signature or ritual behavior became commonplace. Back then, investigators might say the presence, the personality, or the smell of it. What they meant was the precise and peculiar arrangement of details, as distinct as an odor. The experience of crime scene déjà vu. There was the consistent physical description, of course. He was white, in his late teens or twenties, about 5'9", with a medium athletic build. Always in some sort of mask. Forced, angry whisper. Clenched jaw. When he got upset, his voice rose to a higher pitch. Small penis. There was the odd deportment. His voice was often hurried, but his manner was not. He would open a drawer and stand looking at it for several minutes in silence. Reports of prowlers seen in the neighborhood around the time of an attack often included the detail that the prowler, once alerted that he'd been seen, left the area in a leisurely manner. Totally unhurried, one witness said. His psychosexual needs were specific. He bound his victims' hands behind their backs, often tying and retying several times, sometimes with different material. He ordered them to masturbate him with their bound hands. He never fondled them. When he started attacking couples, he'd take the female into the living room and drape a towel over the TV. Lighting seemed important. He got off on sexual questioning. "What am I doing?" he'd ask a blindfolded victim as he masturbated with hand lotion found in the house. "Is this like the captain's?" he asked Jane. Her husband was a captain in the Air Force. He told her to shut up. At least 50 times, Jane said. But when he was raping her, he had other demands, snapping at her like a director to his actress. "Put some emotion in that," he ordered her, "or I'll use my knife." He was brazen. Twice he entered homes, pressing on undeterred when he knew victims had spotted him and were frantically dialing the police. Children didn't bother him. He never hurt them physically, but he would tie up the older ones and put them in another room. He put Jane's toddler son on the bedroom floor during her attack. The boy fell asleep. When he awoke, he peered over the bed. The ear had left. His mother lay bound in strips of torn towels and was gagged with a washcloth. He mistook the ligatures for bandages. "Is the doctor gone?" he whispered. Shelby was familiar with the brute ways of ski-masked perverts. But he was unsettled by this one's commitment to reconnaissance. That was unusual. The hang-up phone calls, pre-prowling, burglaries. The ear knew how to turn off outside lights, even when they were on a timer. He knew where a hard-to-find garage opener was located. Interviews Shelby conducted suggested that the suspect hadn't cased out just Jane, but her neighbors, too, noting where he could park his vehicle, what time the neighbors took out their garbage and left for work. Carol Daly, Shelby's colleague that day, would be quoted a year later in the Sacramento Bee saying about the case, "The typical rapist does not have such elaborate schemes." That was the thought going through Shelby's mind as he stood on the curb with the bloodhound, looking across the field toward Jane's house. Another detail troubled him. The offender had poked Jane's left shoulder with his paring knife. Jane felt he didn't intend to injure her, that the wound was an accident. Shelby wasn't so sure. He guessed the guy was suppressing an urge to inflict more pain. Until he was caught, the urge would grow. It did. The suspect began clicking scissors next to blindfolded victims' ears, threatening to cut off toes, one for each time they moved.
He stabbed the bed next to where they lay. Psychological torment stoked him.
You don't know me, do you?
He whispered to one victim, using her name.
It was too long ago for you, isn't it? It's been a long time, but I know you.
He would always let them believe he'd left their house. Then, just as their bodies would slacken, their numb fingers inching for their ligatures, he'd shock them with a sudden noise or movement. After Jane Carson's attack in October, rumors flew around the community about a serial rapist at large. But the sheriff's department asked the local press to not publicize the crimes, fearing that the spotlight might drive the suspect away from the east side, where they hoped to contain and catch him. Shelby Daly and their colleagues in the detective unit went about quietly chasing leads. They checked with parole and probation officers. They looked at deliverymen, milkmen, janitors, and carpet layers. They left their business cards on neighborhood doors and followed up on tips that came in, usually about young men who stared too hard or stayed out too late, or were, as one tipster said about his younger brother, fruity. They blindfolded Jane and played tape recordings of two suspects' voices for her. She lay on her bed. Her arms shook. "Not him," she said. They canvassed pawn shops for the stolen items and visited House of Eight, a pawn shop on Del Paso Boulevard, inquiring about customers into bondage. They followed up on a tip about a man who was paying the DMV for women's registration information, then following them in his car. They questioned him outside his house, where they noted that he stood in the gutter, too distracted to notice the stream of water swirling around his nice leather dress shoes. He wasn't the ear, but they got the DMV to stop allowing the practice of purchasing private information. They noted blushing, blinking, arm crossing, and repeating questions in a clear grab for time. None of it led to the ear. Meanwhile, gossip in the community mutated in the vacuum of official word. The police weren't telling the public about the rapes, the rumors went, because the details were too horrible to repeat. He was mutilating women's breasts. The rumors weren't true, but the press blackout meant that no one publicly refuted them. Tension peaked on October 18th, when the ear attacked twice in 24 hours. One of the victims, a 32-year-old housewife and mother of two, lived on Kipling Drive in Carmichael, one of the more affluent neighborhoods on the east side. Some speculated that the ear, fed up with his lack of press, was pushing into the nicer neighborhoods to ensure publicity. It worked. 500 people attended a town hall meeting on crime prevention at Deldeo Elementary School on November 3rd. Shelby and Daly took turns at the microphone, awkwardly trying to answer heated and panicky questions about the ear. The next morning, the Sacramento Bee ran a story by police reporter Warren Holloway. Man hunted as suspect in 8 rapes. The press blackout was over. Maybe it was a coincidence, but on the evening of November 10th, the same day the Bee ran a follow-up story, East Area Rapist, Fear Grips Serene Neighborhoods. A man in a leather hood entered the window of a house in Citrus Heights and sneaked up on a 16-year-old girl watching television alone in the den. He pointed a knife at her and issued a chilling warning.
Make one move and you'll be silent forever, and I'll be gone in the dark.
This time the ear took his victim outside the house, leading her down an embankment to a cement drainage ditch about 20 feet wide and 10 feet deep, where they walked about a half mile west to an old willow tree. The girl later retraced the path with Shelby and some other detectives. Cut shoestrings, shredded Levi's, and green panties lay in a heap in weeds near the tree. The girl said she hadn't been raped. Coaxing information from people in the aftermath of a violent attack is tricky, especially when, like Shelby, you're a blunt, 6'3" older male, and the victim is a female teenager who's emotionally about to capsize. You look them in the eye and ask the hard question. You may or may not believe the answer. You ask later, less pointedly, maybe in the middle of talking about something else. They repeat their earlier answer. That's all you can do. The ear may have thought she was someone else.
Don't you go to American River College? He asked her.
When she answered no, he pressed his knife against her throat and asked again. Again she said no. The girl told the detectives she resembled a neighbor who had gone to American River College, a local community college. But there was the weird precision timing again. She was only going to be alone in the house for a short window of time. Her parents had gone to the hospital to visit her brother, and she had a date scheduled with her boyfriend later that night.
Before he took her to the drainage ditch, the ear had carefully replaced the screen on the window he'd entered and turned off